Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly.
You know, most people in the nation think about Appalachia as this one big clump of people, and we're all just alike. We all believe the same way, and we know there's many Appalachias.
Today on our show, we'll be chatting with poets and fiction writers, asking them, how do you describe your Appalachia?
My Appalachia's not, I mean, it is grandma's country quilts and food in some ways, but it's also gas stations and fast food and methamphetamine.
A young writer remembers the first time these negative stereotypes really sunk in when she went to teach English in Bulgaria.
And one of them's like, you're from West Virginia, right? And I'm like, yes, because they told them ahead of time. And they're like, yeah, but you know, a lot of people there are inbred, right? And I'm like, no, I mean, not, I don't think any more than anywhere else.
This next hour, we're going to hear from writers who are reshaping what the outside world thinks about Appalachia. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. On today's show, we're going to hear from a few Appalachian writers and talk about what it means to be Appalachian. Sure, there are plenty of words for what people on the outside like to describe us as. There's hillbilly or redneck, or ignorant or poor, backwoods or even closed-minded. At the same time, Appalachians are often considered resourceful, hardworking, and fiercely loyal. The written word and even spoken word travels further than you might think. So how do the wordsmiths of today describe us? The poets. The people who don't let a day go by without putting down on paper a song or a rhyme or a tale that they just had to get off their chest. What kind of worlds do they create in their writings? I will say, one of the perks to this job is getting to talk with some interesting characters and meet fascinating people. And this week, I'm in luck. And so are you, because today's show is a nonstop conversation with some of the best and most entertaining fiction writers and poets, all from right here in Central Appalachia. We've got Silas House, Frank X. Walker, Glenn Taylor, Scott McClanahan, just to name a few, here on this episode of Inside Appalachia. And by getting to know the literature scene, we'll also get to know the Appalachians and talk about what it means to be from this unique and often misunderstood place we call Appalachia, or Appalachia, or Appalachia, but most of us call it Appalachia. Anyway, several of the writers we'll hear on today's show attended the recent Appalachian Symposium at Berea College in Kentucky. Award-winning author Silas House helped to organize the symposium.
The whole idea of the Appalachian Symposium was to bring as many Appalachian writers together as we possibly could for 2 days of public conversations to just sort of be a public think tank on what is going on in the literature of the region right now. And just, you know, we had 32 writers who came together to talk about the major issues affecting us right now, whether that be environmental issues, or we talked a lot about the way we're portrayed versus the way we really are. We talked about race and gender and sexuality and just, you know, all these issues that have great import for us today as a people. And, of course, we talked a lot about dialect and stereotypes and representation and just, you know, taking control of our own story. I think that's one thing that Appalachian writers really want, is to be able to tell our own stories and to give other people the power to tell their stories as Appalachians.
Silas serves as the National Endowment for the Humanities Chair of Appalachian Literature at Berea College and on the Fiction Faculty at Spalding University's MFA in Creative Writing Program. He's the author of 5 novels, including Clay's Quilt, A Parchment of Leaves, The Coal Tattoo, and others, as well as a few plays. His agent writes, House's writing is known for its attention to the natural world, working class characters, and the plight of the rural place and rural people. I spoke with him recently to get some help understanding what the world of Appalachian literature is all about these days. So how have you seen Appalachian literature change in the last decade or so?
I think that it's changed the same way that living in Appalachia has changed. I think it has become more global. I think it's become more forward-facing. I think, you know, the challenge with Appalachian literature is always that I think writers here feel a real responsibility to honor the past. You know, we take our heritage very seriously. And but at the same time, I think that over the last decade or so, Appalachian writers have become equally concerned with going forward, with, you know, having one hand on the past and one hand on the present or the future. I think that as everything becomes more globalized, so does Appalachia. You know, when I was growing up, we had, I don't know, six channels on the TV, and that was, you know, our access to the world. Mm-hmm. And the radio, that sounds so antiquated now, you know, when you think about the 24-hour news cycle and just the way the internet has opened the world up. I think that it has given us lots of great things in the region, and it's also given us lots of real challenges, too.
I think you touched on this a little bit before, but if you could sort of nail it down, how would you define Appalachian literature as it is right now?
I think Appalachian literature right now in this moment is more contemporary than it used to be. I don't know, 10 or 20 years ago, it seems to me that the literature was more focused on the past. And now I think there's more of a balance of writers who are not only honoring the past, but also trying to write about who we are as a people right now. And I think who we are as a people right now is that we are modern people. Appalachia is a modern place where people are very informed of what's happening globally. I think Appalachia has always been a microcosm for America, but probably even more so lately, you know, as we are just have access to so much information. So, when I think about Appalachians today, I think of modern people. I think of people who are very in touch with everything that's going on in the world. I don't think most people think of Appalachians that way. Most outsiders don't, but I do.
And earlier this month, you organized the Appalachian Symposium at Berea College in Kentucky. From what you heard at the symposium, what would you say is the trend, if any, within this Appalachian writers community?
I think the community right now is just very focused on inclusivity. They want to make sure that people know there are many Appalachias. And that's something that the greater nation doesn't know. You know, most people in the nation think about Appalachia as this one big clump of people, and we're all just alike. We all believe the same way. We all go to the same church. We all look alike, etc. And we know there's many Appalachias. There's many ways of being. And the writers who were at the symposium, I think, represented that very well. The diversity of thought and race, ways of being, religiosity, whatever, were represented at the symposium. I think, that diversity is what makes us a strong people, and it always has to a large degree.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever feel resistance whenever you say that, or criticism of perpetuating the stereotypes that we as Appalachians are closed-minded and not trusting of outsiders? I'm curious to know how you deal with that.
Well, I think that we have a right to be somewhat suspicious. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at the way we've been portrayed for, 150 years by the media, of course we'd be a little bit hesitant, to trust others to tell our stories. On one hand, I say that without hesitation. On the other hand, I always want to point out that there are instances of outsiders telling our stories properly, and I always try to give a couple of examples of those. But I think across the board, when you look at the way Appalachians have been represented, almost always they're in better hands when they're being represented by Appalachians. I mean, it's just the result of gestational sense of place. You know what I mean? I mean, you can't drive through this place and understand it. So I think it's mostly the result of really being encamped in a place. And there are plenty of people who are not, wouldn't be geographically defined as Appalachians, who really understand this place and represent it properly. And I think there are lots of people who are born and bred here who don't understand it and can't articulate it, you know? So I do think that ultimately it's just about the storyteller and their intentions. So I think there are good and bad examples in both cases.
I think I could probably talk to you for a few days, but I should probably get off here.
Well, I'd be glad to do that. Glad to be here.
Silas says we need more Appalachians telling Appalachian stories. He's an award-winning Appalachian author and teacher at Berea College. What do you think of his idea that Appalachia is getting more diverse? Are there many versions of Appalachia? We want to know more about what your Appalachia is like. Just send us a tweet at InAppalachia and use the hashtag MyAppalachia to share a sentence, a thought, a poem about what Appalachia is to you. What's your life like right now? What's important to you? If you had to explain to the world in just one tweet who you are as an Appalachian, what would you say? We'll read some of those on the air in an upcoming episode. Just be sure to use the hashtag MyAppalachia. Silas House mentioned that a lot of the writers at the conference in Berea want to make sure that the diverse voices in our region get heard. That's one of the goals of another writer who attends the symposium in Berea. He's made it his mission to say as loudly and as often as possible that people and artists of color are part of the past and present of the multi-state Appalachian region. Frank X. Walker is the former Poet Laureate of Kentucky. He's from Danville, Kentucky, and the co-founder of the Afrolachian Poets. Frank Walker also coined the word Afrolachia. Here he is, back in 2013, talking about why he hopes to challenge the idea that literature in Appalachia is not diverse.
And I think the challenge is, when people talk about the region, is to first not see it as homogeneous and all white. And to acknowledge that it's broad enough to include a Birmingham and a Pittsburgh, that is both rural and urban. And only then will we be able to shake away from those hard and false stereotypes and caricatures that are still pervasive. And it's a shame. And I think it's the only people who can do it are people who live in this space and work in this space. That outsiders are not going to do it, because I think they still enjoy the power of having somebody to laugh at. But they're laughing at something that's not true.
Frank says he thinks his role as a writer and teacher is to work for social justice and to bring more diverse voices into the fold of Appalachian Lit.
Well, I would say my contributions include forcing a discussion of the true diversity of the region. My contributions include getting people to recommit to poetry. I think to kind of erase this myth about poetry not belonging to everybody. Part of my work is missionary work. I'm trying to recruit new fans of poetry, people who not just appreciate poetry, but recognize that they need some and want some of that in their life. And as a teacher of young writers and artists, I think that, you know, my contribution is teaching and educating the next generation of artists and writers from the region.
In many of his poems, Frank X. Walker writes about the civil rights struggles from the 1960s. In his poem, After Birth, he writes about a white supremacist named Byron De La Beckwith, who was sentenced to life in prison after shooting an African-American field secretary for the NAACP.
Funny how life and death is a whole lot of pushing and pulling, holding and seeking breath, a whole world turned upside down until somebody screams.
That was Frank X. Walker, the co-founder of the Afrolachian Poets and a former Poet Laureate of Kentucky. Thanks to Cecilia Mason and the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, who sent us those recordings of Walker. The current Poet Laureate in Kentucky is George Ella Lyon. By the way, on our website, we've posted an audio recording from the recent Appalachian Heritage Writers Symposium that took place at Berea College. Head to wvpublic.org to hear writers Silas House, Denise Giardina, and Frank X. Walker discuss whether activism is an inherent part of writing about Appalachia. Up next, we're going to hear from fiction writer Scott McClanahan. He's an author from Southern West Virginia who's written 6 books, including The Collected Works of Scott McClanahan, Volume 1, Crapalachia, Hill William, and more. Crapalachia is a raw, gritty, and humorous memoir. It was released in 2013, but it's still getting positive attention. Earlier this month, the book was listed by the Huffington Post as one of the 17 books you should add to your usual back-to-school list. McClanahan called Crapalachia a biography of place. For me, the book offered a glimpse into some challenging and often humorous realities that come along with dealing with tough statistics. The New York Times Book Review wrote, McClanahan's prose is miasmic, dizzying, repetitive, a rushing river of words that reflects the chaos and humanity of the place from which he hails. McClanahan aims to lasso the moon. He is not a writer of half measures. The man has purpose. This is his symphony, every note designed to resonate, to linger. When the book was first released, Scott shared his thoughts on being recognized nationally, but also as a regional writer. Here he is back in 2013 in an interview with West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Dave Mistich.
If you want to, just go ahead and sort of speak a little bit into the microphone. I'll check the levels.
I'm speaking a little bit into the microphone.
All right.
Checking the levels.
Perfect. Do you feel like West Virginia or Appalachia is losing its identity at all? Or are we, like, you know, I don't know if you want to use the word isolated, but are we sort of maybe a touch immune to that?
Well, see, that's always my problem, too, when I think even when I'm a big fan of the Harry Smith, you know, folk collection, you know, the Smithsonian put out. Those people aren't isolated. Johnson City, Tennessee is a thoroughfare. Bristol, Tennessee is, you know, the home of millionaires in the same way that Southern West Virginia. But I think my Appalachia is different than the Appalachia that people think of. My Appalachia is not, I mean, it is grandma's country quilts and food in some ways, but it's also gas stations and fast food and methamphetamine, and at least now, and in the world that television, right? I watched MTV just like any kid in New Jersey did. Is that Appalachia? Yeah, maybe. Maybe not. I'm not sure.
You've been doing a lot of traveling for readings for this book. Whenever you show up to something like this and these folks have either read Crapalachia or have heard about it, you know, do you get the feeling that they expect some sort of weird hillbilly show? What are they expecting, and what do you think they're expecting?
Well, for instance, one guy came up to me and he said, "Your accent's affected, right?" Stressing the A, affected. And then he explained to me that he had relatives in Northern Virginia, which is, of course, very different from this place. And they got rid of their accents because they sounded ignorant. So you're always dealing with that stereotype, but I've attempted to try to at least use the stereotype or at least manipulate the stereotype rather than rebelling against or feeling insecure about it, which I think is what we typically do. We have this sense of pride in this state, which is a good thing, but there's also a negative biblical aspect to pride as well, where we want to make sure that you understand, you know, we're from a place that you're not from, but also if you say something bad about it, we're going to immediately become offended in 10 seconds.
Did you ever second guess the idea of the importance of being from West Virginia? For example, maybe it's only important to us because we're from this particular place and have some idea of the culture and the identity here. You know, obviously people from other regions and states feel unique too. And that, with all that being said, how do you sort of qualify the importance of being from West Virginia?
I think there's something still mythic about the place. There's something that hasn't been broken apart by postmodernism or modernism or any of these sort of movements. There's still something that is the belief that, you know, an individual could exist within this area. And it's not isolated. It's an incubator. And I think if you look at it as an incubator and producing individuals, because I can't stand people, right? I mean, I have nothing. I want nothing to do with them. But I love individuals, and that is what the state is about, or maybe what it used to be about. I think there's some changes probably going on.
The book has gotten very positive reviews, namely from the Oxford American and the Washington Post. Is it a strange feeling at all to see your book reviewed by so-called prestigious outlets? I can't imagine any of the types of characters that you're writing about, are reading highbrow outlets for their book suggestions. Does it feel weird to sort of take a book like Crapalacha and find it in places of literary prestige, I guess you'd say?
Honestly, no. I think it belongs in those places. I think sometimes what writers from a region, even though Chinua Achebe is writing about a region too, or whoever you want, Virginia Woolf's writing about a region, they're all regionalists, in some ways. I think we kind of market ourselves in that region. I love West Virginia, and I'm staying here. I mean, I had to fight to stay here, as any young person's had to fight to get a job and stay in this area that they love. But I've always looked outside that because I didn't want to be kind of pigeonholed as that regional individual.
That was writer Scott McClanahan talking with reporter Dave Mistich. McClanahan's works include a memoir about his time growing up in West Virginia called Crapalacha. You can find more of this interview with Scott McClanahan and hear more of his no-nonsense explanation of the nature of writing on our website, wvpublic.org.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
True story. I once trained to be a raft guide on the New River here in West Virginia. I didn't complete the training, so I wouldn't call myself a guide. But the guides who took us down the river would often tell stories to tourists as we floated. One story, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, was about a poker game that went on at a train station in Thurmond, West Virginia for 13 years. Well, it turns out that a new novel features a poker game that was played for over 13 years. It's the latest novel by Glenn Taylor, a West Virginia writer who is known to be a master of weaving plenty of oral history and folklore into his books. The main characters in his new novel are a professional gambler and his girlfriend who owns a local brothel. The book is called A Hanging at Cinder Bottom. It's set in McDowell County's Red Light District of Keystone, West Virginia, at the turn of the 19th century. Roxy Todd sat down with Taylor recently to talk with him about where these stories came from.
During the boom days of coal, places like Keystone were said to have their fair share of shootouts, card players, and red light districts. 100 years ago, characters came to McDowell County by horse or by train from all over the world. Like his first novel, The Ballad of Trenchmouth Taggart, Glenn Taylor's latest book weaves imagination, history, and tall tales into a story that feels like it was dreamed up late at night around a campfire. Taylor is a native of Huntington, West Virginia, but his father grew up in Matewan, where a lot of those stories were told, mostly by men.
I think as a kid growing up, you're always going to be around uncles and other acquaintances who make jokes about, where's such and such. Well, he's headed down to Cinder Bottom, Well, he's gone down to Keystone for the weekend, And it became clear at some age that what they were joking about were whorehouses, for lack of a better term. Houses of ill fame, if we want to sound a little more proper, because they were still going. I was born in 1975, and there are some who will tell you that you could still entertain that kind of notion all the way up through, maybe the 80s. And so I kind of heard about it as a kid. I don't think I paid much attention and, of course, was just innocent as could be, so didn't understand any of it. No, I'm just kidding. But I've heard about it for quite some time.
Will you read one of the opening scenes of your novel, A Hanging at Cinder Bottom, the one where the epic poker game is about to begin?
I would be happy to. This chapter is called Queens Full of Fours, February 17th, 1897. It was Wednesday. Snow had stuck to the mountaintop, but not the road. It was the day on which a game of stud poker commenced in Keystone that would last 13 years. It wasn't intended to last that long. It was intended instead to carry in the kind of money most couldn't tote, and it would do so in a quiet fashion, for the game itself was the only of that day's events not publicized by handbill in the growing town. You must see the lobby to believe it, the papers said. Grand opening, Alhambra Hotel. It was Henry Trent's most ambitious project to date, a 3-story brick building with 4 columns in front. He'd build it on the southwest bank of Elkhorn Creek, where the moneyed folk had moved. 5 men had been invited by courier to sit at the big stakes table. One of the 5 was Abe Baich, then 17 years of age. Having already cleaned the pockets of the men at his daddy's saloon, he had a reputation. Most had quit calling him Pretty Boy Baich in favor of the Keystone Kid.
Your heroes in the novel sort of take on the rich villains who basically run Keystone. Why'd you decide to kind of pit these characters that have been taken advantage of by the millionaires, basically, and they take them on? Why'd you decide that?
I think part of it has to do with I'm a sucker, like many readers and writers, for a good underdog story. I just always have been. I think it maybe is something that is generated among those of us born and raised in West Virginia who then leave the state, and you kind of have an underdog mentality, perhaps. Part of it is probably also because I'll just go ahead and say it, I've never been very good at plot. And so the long con was a way for me to kind of keep myself on track. I had them take on the powers that be in a very calculated way because that helped me calculate how to write the book.
Glenn, thank you so much for coming in and chatting with me.
It was my pleasure.
That was fiction writer Glenn Taylor speaking with our producer, Roxy Todd. You know, there's a song called Cinderbottom Blues that was also inspired by some of these tales about the red light district of Cinderbottom in Keystone, West Virginia. Here's John Lilly and the band Blue Yonder playing the tune.
Now the girls up Cinderbottom, pretty and they're fat. They won't take IOU, the dealer strictly cash. Long as you keep spending, the smile will treat you nice. When your spending's ending, cut you like a knife. Cinderbottom blues, Cinderbottom blues. Oh, you got 'em, Cinderbottom blues.
Some of these stories and songs that linger in the mountains just seem too far-fetched to be true. Imagine a brothel or red light district in the scarcely populated McDowell County town. Maybe it's just hard for folks like me to imagine since I wasn't around and don't really remember the heydays or boom times. Incorporating styles of folklore into fiction, as we just heard from Taylor before, is a strong tradition in lots of Appalachian literature, especially for fiction writers, and even some elements of magical realism. Up next, we're going to hear from another West Virginia writer, Huntington native Marie Manila. Her latest novel is The Patron Saint of Ugly. It's set in a fictional West Virginia town, and most of it is told in the form of transcripts of archived tapes. She said her work is inspired by magical realist fiction writers of South America, like Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Dave Mistich spoke with Marie Manila about her novel and how folklore fits into her style of Appalachian lit.
I guess I want to start by talking a little bit about Patron Saint of Ugly.
Mm-hmm.
Set up the story for us. Tell us a little bit about what it's about.
Okay. The novel is about a young woman named Garnet Ferrari who is born with port wine birthmarks covering her body that look like a map of the world. And her Italian grandmother insists that she's the descendant of a 16th century Sicilian saint who was similarly modeled and who could also heal people. And there are people who are healed in my Garnet's presence. So now pilgrims have set up a tent city outside her hilltop home in Sweetwater, West Virginia. And now the Vatican is investigating her. Garnet does not think she has any healing abilities. So she's dictating tapes to an archbishop in 1975, trying to debunk the myth and send the pilgrims and the Vatican packing.
And so tell me a little bit about the style, and you mentioned the interviews and the tapings.
Yep.
Is it more difficult to write in that style, trying to tell the story through those transcripts, through that interview sort of style, as compared to, I guess, your standard narrative?
It actually gave me a lot of freedom. When I started writing about 25 years ago, I fell in love with the magical realism of Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Isabel Allende. And I love the folkloric qualities, particularly of Garcia Marquez. So I had to really mature as a writer to be able to pull that off in a believable way. And I think finally in Patron Saint of Ugly, I felt competent enough to do it. And using the vehicle of tapes gave me so much freedom to infuse it with those folklore stories. And in fact, there are a few times throughout the novel that the Italian grandmother steals the tape recorder and she makes her own tape. And then an Aunt Betty steals the tape recorder and she makes her own tape. So everybody's trying to set the record straight. And my narrator, Garnet, may at times be an unreliable narrator. So you also have that theme rolling throughout the novel. So I actually love the device of using the tapes.
Tell me a little bit about Sweetwater. It's obviously a fictional town in West Virginia. Did you find the process of coming up with a fictional place difficult, or did that sort of make it easier given the story itself and the sort of fantastical nature of the story?
I was born in Huntington, West Virginia, and I grew up around an area called Gallagher Village, which is where the Catholic Church and the Catholic school that I attended are Our Lady of Fatima. And I modeled my Sweetwater Village after Gallagher Village, right down to the pharmacy. There was a pharmacy called Nearman's that I borrowed. That's where the candy counter was and the soda fountain. There was a movie theater there where all the kids would go on Saturday morning to get their fix. So I sort of reshaped it a little bit. But in my mind, all the hills that I grew up in, I turned into kind of one hill atop which lives my reluctant saint. And the hill funnels down into one street called Appian Way, because there are a lot of Italians in this novel. I kind of dug into my Italian ancestry for this book. But I had a lot of fun trying to get nostalgic with my youth in Gallagher Village and put that into Sweetwater Village. And there's even a plant there where the father worked, where my father worked at the nickel plant in Huntington. So I have the plant there that's based on the nickel plant. And it was a joy, a pleasure and a joy.
This book's been getting a lot of attention.
Yes.
It's got a big publisher.
Yes.
What's the feeling, all this happening right now? Is there feelings of rejoice, obviously?
Yes.
but what about moving forward? You've still got plenty of writing left in you, I'm sure. What's the feeling moving forward? And what are people saying about the book whenever they talk about
well,
it?
Well, so far, reviews have been wonderful. And I knew when I was finishing up my solid draft of this novel, I knew that it was really special. And I wanted it to have professional representation. So I found an awesome agent who also was in love with it. And she's the one who got it into the hands of the editor at Houghton Mifflin, who also fell in love with it. And that's every writer's dream. And I took a lot of risks with this book. Anytime you're writing folkloric and magical realism, and your readers really have to suspend their disbelief. And some readers are willing to go there with you, and some are not. And so I understood that. But when this editor from Houghton Mifflin, Lauren Ween, fell in love with it and was willing to champion it, I thought, okay, this is my shot. This is the book that has a shot at it. And so far, reviews have been just fabulous, and it's been making some nice reading lists. Entertainment Weekly put it like number one on their summer reads list, which was pretty phenomenal for this woman from West Virginia. This book is going to get out there. And I have to be honest, that does put some weight on you for what are you going to write now? What are you going to write now? Well, the good news is I already started it about 2 years ago. I started my next novel because I knew the editing process is very slow and it just takes time. You know, your editor has it for a year. You can't just sit on your hands. And as a writer, I know I always go a little crazy if I'm not working on a project. So the next book also has a lot of folkloric, mythological, magical realism elements in it, also set in a made up West Virginia town. I love including unexpected elements. In Patron Saint of Ugly, there's a noir short story. There's a 60-minute transcript. Mike Wallace appears, you know, to interview. There are two pages with just the letter Z on it. So I'm doing a little bit of that in my new novel, which has a working title of Blood Orchard. I have a captivity narrative from a woman who was, you know, taken by Native Americans during the French and Indian War. So I have a little bit of that in there. I have a lot of humor and a lot of tragedy, which is also what I go for. You never know. A friend of mine said, Marie, after she finished reading Patron Saint, she said, Marie, you can die happy now. You know, she loved the book. I accomplished everything I wanted to accomplish. And if I never write another book, she said, you can die happy. So I'm trying to keep that in mind, though. I know I will always write.
Do you feel that way, though?
I have to say I am so in love with this novel, with The Patron Saint of Ugly. I put everything in it. I put the bathroom sink in it. I put everything that I had, everything that I felt, everything that I loved about. They always tell you to write novels that you'd want to read, and this is the one I would want to read because it does. It has a lot of humor. It has a lot of tragedy, a lot of pathos, and it's also playful and fun. And I don't know if I'll ever top it. I don't know if a writer should ever say that. I don't know if I'll ever top it, but I just am smitten, completely smitten with it.
Great. Well, Marie Manila, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Great.
Last year, Marie Manila's novel, The Patron Saint, won the Weatherford Award, which is sponsored by the Appalachian Studies Association and Berea College. The award honors books that best illuminate the challenges, personalities, and unique qualities of the Appalachian South. Manila reports that she's just finishing writing the new novel with the working title of The Interpreter of Waller's Ferry. The book is a gender-bending, race-blending saga that spans West Virginia's history from the French and Indian War to the present day. Three chapters have been published, or are forthcoming, in Monkey Bicycle, China Grove, and Mad Hatter's Review. So, I honestly want to know, what books by Appalachian writers have you discovered recently? Send us a tweet at @InAppalachia, and don't forget, like we said earlier in the show, we want to hear what Appalachia means to you. Hey, why not write in a tweet your poem about my Appalachia? Can you write a poem in less than 140 characters minus the hashtag #MyAppalachia? And also, on our website, you'll find some really fantastic photos of the writers you've been hearing on our show today as children. You can see what writers like Marie Manila and Glenn Taylor looked like when they were growing up in Appalachia. Oh, and also, there's a few of our favorite Appalachian writers that we couldn't fit into this week's show, but we've posted links to their books on our website. So check it out. That's wvpublic.org. Next, we're going to hear from a young creative writing student who didn't fall in love with Appalachian writing when she was first introduced to it. In fact, she resisted it. The late Irene McKinney was her teacher. You might recognize the name. She was the Poet Laureate of West Virginia for 18 years. Eventually, Irene McKinney's message that Appalachians should be proud and should defend their people sank in for Caitlin Witt, and it changed her life. Roxy Todd talked with her about the time in her life when she realized what it meant to find her Appalachian voice.
The first day Irene came into class, she had dyed her hair like orange red, like flame red, and had it in little pigtails, the kind of like the ponytail holders that had the two plastic balls on either side. And she had on all black, but then she had this pink wrap on, this like neon pink wrap. And she'd put on her cane the tape that's like floral tape. And she came in and she told us that, you know, we were going to read a lot of literature that was going to be about Appalachia and that it was going to be angry and it was going to be hurtful and upsetting. And that was good because people in Appalachia, that's how they felt. Or if they didn't, they should. And she asked us if we were from Appalachia. Like how many people in the class were to raise our hand, and I did because I knew by then I was from Appalachia, but some people didn't. And she asked them the states, and she said, well, you're from Appalachia. And one boy, I remember he was from Ohio, and he said, no, I'm not. And she said, yes, you are. And they had this mini argument, and she's like, are you ashamed of it? And he, you know, wouldn't really answer her. And then we all kind of knew that, yeah. And she's like, is everybody ashamed of it? And no one would really say anything. And I always felt really crappy about that moment now. But then I was like, why is this insane woman who comes here and tells us we should feel good about this place that isn't very good and, you know, it's not special in any way, somewhere you want to leave. Everyone wants to leave here. She told us all we had to write. We had this, like, creative project towards the end of the semester, so it would have been one of the last times I ever saw her. And I wrote this poem, and she gave it back to me, and she's like, this is a pretty good poem, but I don't want you to write somebody else's life. I want you to write about your life. And I did, and she liked it. And I remember I was really happy. It made me feel good that she liked it, and she was happy with me, even though I was still always mad at her because she pushed me to write things and talk about things I prefer to ignore and suppress as much as I could. I wanted to pass is what the only word I can really think of. I remember standing in the bathroom and trying to, like, whisper things and thinking, okay, I can still hear your accent, not being smart enough to realize. But Irene didn't. Irene had an accent and she didn't care, and she said the word ain't all the time. And again, all of my, you know, English teachers in high school and elementary school and middle school had said, you know, if you write the word ain't, you know, I'll take off 10 points. If you say the word ain't in your presentation, I'll take off 10 points. And she didn't care. And that was strange for me.
Part of you finding your voice is sort of, it sounds like, accepting that anger that was there, and maybe is,
yeah,
like Irene taught you guys a little bit to recognize that, mm-hmm, the anger. Is that part of the voice that you found?
Yeah. I remember one of my friends who was in Appalachian Lit with me. She was from somewhere else. And she would talk about, like, she's like, Appalachian literature is so defensive. And I agreed with her, and I'm like, it is so defensive. And I don't know why. And you should just calm down and not be so defensive. Because we couldn't understand why it was so defensive. And I understand now that's, you know, an immature way of looking at it. And it's a response a lot of people have when they get challenged. You know, is that I don't know why you're being so defensive. And, you know, it's not my fault. I'm not doing anything personally. But Irene was right on the first day. I mean, I'm still very angry. Some of my first drafts of poems are too angry, and I have to calm it down some because it just comes off as just anger, and not, there's not really art or melody or anything in there. I have to, you know, pare it back. And it made me mad, honestly. I was mad about it. Because it was being confronted with something you knew you had to confront eventually, and you were angry. And so I tried to resist in different ways, and it didn't really work forever. But I kept resisting. I think I would have broke probably earlier had I been around her more, and had she been able to be in class more with us and do conferences and things she had planned but wasn't able to do because of her illness. So I was able to suppress it for longer. And then my senior year in December, they sent an email around and told everyone she had passed away, which was, I remember being very, very sad and not knowing why I was so sad, because again, she had made me so angry. you'd have thought I'd been like, well, that's sad, but, you know, not like crying in your dorm room sad, which I did, which a lot of people did. And I was confused by it. Like, why was I so sad? And I think I was sad because I knew I should have thanked her, and I didn't.
The year Irene McKinney passed away, Caitlin was a senior in college at Wesleyan. She still thought her dream was to go on to D.C. and become a lawyer. Caitlin was chosen that year to help edit Wesleyan's literary journal, and they decided to dedicate that year's issue to Irene McKinney. In the journal's dedication, they printed one of McKinney's poems called At 24, which had a lot of importance for Caitlin.
It's a wonderful poem. It's a poem that probably anybody in their 20s can relate to, but especially people who do anything creative in their 20s. It's a beautiful poem. It's talking about, the narrator's talking about kind of this freeing moment where she's not going to let certain people in the poem have her or have whatever she is. It was, "Dear Mr. President, I said, dear Dean, dear husband, dear our father, dear tax collector, you don't know me. I don't know what I am, but whatever it is, you can't have me." And I remember thinking about what that meant and thinking, I'm not going to let, you know, this other place have me. I like Appalachia. And that was a weird moment because I had never liked it. And I'm like, that kind of would be what it'd be like for me to let, you know, this other place have me and give over to it and give over to dressing a certain way and sounding a certain way. And not saying anyone who lives that life is doing that, but for me, it would have been, I would have been turning in another person.
So then, Caitlin graduated from college, and she was selected to teach English in Bulgaria as a Fulbright scholar. That's when all the things Irene McKinney had taught her in her Appalachian literature class began to make sense.
When I lived abroad, and I lived in Bulgaria, and I was away from, that was the first time I'd ever been away from Appalachia.
What made you, I mean, was it a feeling of seeing another culture sort of and being fascinated by their traditions and connecting it back to your own? Or what was it that clicked?
It was a few things, I think. One of them was seeing another culture and like being entirely outside of it. I'd never lived in a culture where I was the one who was on the outside. And then I guess I could see in a way that and then when I researched about Bulgaria, I'd always liked Eastern European culture. I liked the music and I liked the folklore. And then when I was in Bulgaria, I was able to see like a lot of things in Bulgaria were similar to Appalachia. They have a really vast, I suppose is the only word I can think of, a really vast folklore tradition. And people there still follow folklore traditions like they do in Appalachia. Bulgaria and Bulgarian people, there's a lot of stereotypes about them that exist, and they're mostly negative stereotypes in the rest of Europe. They have different dialects. Bulgarian people can tell, like, oh, that person's from Gabrovo, that person's from Varna. I couldn't, but they could. And I could see those similarities in contrast to Appalachia and think, okay, Bulgaria is a culture, and this is, we call it a culture. And then it was the first time I'm like, oh, okay, Appalachia is also a culture. People from Appalachia, when we're speaking, we're not using the English language incorrectly. That's a dialect. We don't have made up words. We have colloquialisms. But I wasn't able to see that until I could compare it to another culture, if that makes sense. It was also when you live in another culture who is aware of your culture, but from a distance, they'll say and do things that upset you. But they would say, like, the first day of class, I told them, you can ask me, you know, questions or things you want to know about me. And one of them's like, you're from West Virginia, right? And I'm like, yes, because they told them ahead of time. And they're like, yeah, but, you know, a lot of people there are inbred, right? And I'm like, no, I mean, not, I don't think any more than anywhere else. And I'm like, that's an odd first day question. But no, but they didn't think it was, because that's, and I suppose I didn't realize how far the stereotypes, the negative stereotypes about Appalachia carried over. I never imagined the first day I was in class with Bulgarian kids that would come up. I mean, it comes up here. It comes up when I go to other states. But I didn't think it would go that far. And it did. And that upset me. So I thought, maybe this is a more serious problem than I thought. And maybe when Irene McKinney came into Appalachian literature and she was angry about something she saw in the news when someone would use the word redneck as an insult, and everyone would know when they said redneck, they meant someone who was poor, someone who was prejudiced, someone who was uncouth in some way, that redneck just automatically people thought that they knew what they were talking about and should be furious about that. When I was a sophomore, I'm like, what are you so mad about? But then when it happened to me and I was in front of all these students in another country, I mean, a whole entire ocean away, I was really upset.
Now, Caitlin is studying creative writing at Virginia Tech. In the summers, she works on her parents' farm in Nicholas County, West Virginia. She also collects artifacts from times gone by, and she makes jewelry out of those trinkets from the past. She wants to be a writer, and she's learning how to find her own voice from her own experiences.
Caitlin Witt's former teacher at Westland College was the late Irene McKinney, who passed away from cancer in 2012. McKinney was the Poet Laureate of West Virginia for 18 years. She continued to write and teach in the last year of her life. Irene McKinney's last book of poems, called Have You Had Enough Darkness Yet?, was published in 2014 after McKinney passed. The current Poet Laureate of West Virginia, Mark Harshman, has been curating works from Appalachian poets for our show. Let's listen as he shares some of his thoughts on Irene McKinney and reads two of her poems, Personal and The Walk.
Irene McKinney, a remarkable woman, admired as a poet and teacher, and nowhere more so than in Appalachia. Irene was born in Bealington, West Virginia in 1939 and appointed poet laureate in 1994 and served until her death in 2012. The list of teachers and writers throughout Appalachia whose lives she's touched would be too long for this show. Irene was the kind of poet who could accomplish in a few seconds that deep trust with readers that compel them to follow her words, words which were not only frank and stunning in their insights, but were to become poems you felt were written just for you. Personal. None of this is personal, not the way you'd think. The moon keeps on traveling, and I can see it from my balcony each night, and each night different, but it's not my own, not like we want things to be our very own. But it sways me nevertheless, and stands in for certain losses and gains, and for even that much I'm grateful. I stand at the back door and stare. The walk. Dripping with sweetness, the afternoon spreads its creamy golden hands over me. What are those flowers? Jewelweed, some the orange pink of genital flesh, some the buttery yellow of souffle, then the layer upon layer of green in the shining afternoon, the walk that began at the house surrounded by green grass, then weeds at the side of the path, up through the layers, the low-growing shrubs, sassafras, bayberry with its red knobs in a cluster, sweet gum with small, dry leaves, ferny locust, then the towering maples and oak, waving and waving, follow me. Light down through the layers, moving up through the ladders of rays. God doesn't want anything. These poems are from Vivid Companion, the Vandalia Press, West Virginia University Press, 2004. So, thanks for listening. I'm Mark Harshman, wishing you good words in the air and on the page.
Like I said earlier in the show, I never really was a bookworm, and learning about this world of Appalachian writers is intriguing. Maybe it's because I'm competitive and want to see West Virginians or Appalachians do well. Maybe it's because I can relate to the writings. Or maybe it's just inspiring to think that someone with a similar background as me can have their name in print, a name that folks across the country seek out to find. Maybe they want to see it as another subject to mock or ridicule at first. But like so many authors said today, once they get to know us, they can't help but to fall in love. Because while fancy Hollywood writers are trying to come up with the next big plot line of an underdog with strength and courage while living through conflict and dismissal, many of us Appalachians live it. My Appalachia is different from your Appalachia, and that's okay. If you're not happy with what you see in the media or what you read from the shelf, maybe you should write too. But as a friend once told me, maybe it's time for us to quit being proud of surviving and start thriving. I found Scott McClanahan's book, Crapalachia, a few years ago. Scott said it was a biography of place, and I agree. It reminded me a lot of my Appalachia. Hashtag, there's beauty and pain, laughter and tears throughout. Our producer is Roxy Todd, with help this week from Jesse Wright and Scotty White. Our editor is Catherine Winter. Music in today's show was also provided by Tom Breeding and John Lilly and Blue Yonder with Cinder Bottom Blues. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at @InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.